Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
And today we're going to talk about Roger Bacon. Roger Bacon was a Franciscan monk and he lived from 1214 to 1294. So 13th century again, we're talking same time as like Albertus Magnus and that kind of medieval time frame.
He was a celebrated teacher known as Dr. Mirabilis, which in Latin means wonderful teacher.
Okay. What's this scholastic accolade?
That would be a kudos, a tip of the cap to his scholastic endeavors. And that's because when he was teaching, when he was really going at it, he was a master at Oxford, lecturing on Aristotle, then later the University of Paris, and then joined the Franciscan order and officially quit teaching at that point. But until that point, he was a master of letters.
Dude, you sound like you're in a really good mood. Is this
It's called Red Bull and Shame.
Red Bull and Shame. And that, all right. So two negatives sometimes make a positive, right?
Fantastic. Have fun editing that.
Anyways, so as a monk, what's interesting is they weren't really supposed to publish without the order's consent. I guess it's kind of obvious. You know, they're part of a greater order. And so he had a lot of ideas that, he was, again, we see this over and over of these people that get this alchemist reputation that they kind of had a tendency to look at empirical methods or, he also studied Arabic work. So, you know, to actually use your experience from the field and not just read out of books, okay?
But here's the thing. He felt empowered to do this because Pope Clement IV was his buddy. Right, he was his close friend. What this meant was that he got the green light from the Pope, and so he felt empowered to write about this stuff. But here's where it went south on him: when the Pope died unexpectedly, this then became heretical speech at some point, I'm sure, and he was imprisoned. Well, we don't really know why he was imprisoned.
Right, it's kind of a mystery.
But
still,
this makes sense without his benefactor alive anymore to protect him, and Pope Clement IV. I think it was up for grabs that he was probably saying things that weren't in the church's best interest.
Yeah, some of the theories are that he had kind of liked to buy into contemporary prophecies of the time, which other monks kind of looked down upon. And he had interest in certain astrological doctrines, which a lot of people did. I mean, this is, even within the church. And then there's another theory that his personality might have played a big role, which we've also seen in
many times. This is actually part of the mold.
Yeah, exactly.
The alchemist. But, looking ahead at his order, the Franciscan order, of course, comes after their patron saint, Francis of Assisi. And they followed that Franciscan ideal as an order to help those less fortunate take a vow of poverty. They were kind of on the outside looking in a lot of ways during this time. Because when you think about Pope Clement IV and Pope Urban at the time, these guys were living large, man. I mean, in the church doctrine, they followed their own path. It wasn't necessarily the path of the church. So a Franciscan, if I'm not mistaken, at the time would have been kind of on the outside looking in. They were I don't want to say hippies, but they were aesthetics and a little
quieter.
Exactly. Yeah. They weren't all into the material way of living. So already he's at a point where he's on the outside looking in, and this does play into the part where he might have been in prison or on the blacklist for his belief system.
But we don't know for sure.
I'm just speculating at this point. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That part's lost to history.
So, I like to talk about some of the science things he did do, because later we'll get into some of the kooky theories, but he did delve into optics, which we've also seen before. He criticized the Julian calendar, so he thought he had a better idea, and he strongly kind of fought for or promoted the idea that natural sciences should be taught in universities, and to, so like I said, experimentally test theories and that kind of thing. So kind of, you know, go about it in an empirical, reproducible way. But really, science and universities? Like, what was he thinking? I
mean, well, you know, it's really this is, when we think about university, we think, well, where the name comes from is universal. And the idea is to be universally exposed to what knowledge set humans have at that time. But that wasn't always the case.
Well, they had very different ideas of – yeah.
Exactly. I mean, and some of these things really caused political rifts among the kings or emperors or potentates that were where these universities were located. And so if you really push the envelope maybe beyond the theocracy of the time and the location, you could get yourself in some serious trouble as a professor or even as a student attending these classes. So when you say that he really kind of pushed the envelope – he was playing with fire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, he was, In 13th century, definitely. You know, there were some kind of secular universities that quote-unquote secular universities that, you know, emperors and kings set up. But still, they're probably run by the church in some fashion or other.
Well, we see that here in Prague with Charles University, one of the older universities in Europe. And there were some issues that we had seen where someone would profess, and that was actually even Jan Hus, if I'm not mistaken, was a lecturer at Charles University. Boy, I hope I didn't get that wrong, but I think he was.
Jan Jasinski was.
Yeah,
was
and at some point, because his rhetoric got him kicked out.
Yeah.
So, and then of course led him to the funeral pyre, while still alive, actually. So it wouldn't be a funeral pyre, but it did play a part.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, it wasn't just the universities that criticized him. I mean, it obviously went both ways. He criticized many of his contemporaries, including Albertus Magnus, who we did a podcast on. And I find that interesting because I wouldn't lump them together, but they have some similarities. Like, they got their reputation for being alchemists by looking at nature. But anyways, apparently Roger Bacon didn't like Albertus's methods or something about him. I mean, he criticized many others. Now, I want to talk about his works, like some of the things we did or some of the things he wrote. But I need to kind of point out here that a lot of the things attributed to him, and we see this over and over also, weren't actually something he wrote. So after he died, he got a reputation for being an alchemist. So then when they looked back and they found some alchemical writing, then they would just assume that he wrote it. And a lot of the Roger Bacon quotes in kind of the 16th, 17th centuries weren't actually written by him at all. So he and then also, you know, he was, because of his reputation, he was in fiction a lot. So he's definitely a larger than life figure. What I want to start with is something he definitely did write. So this we know, okay? And that's the Opus Majus. And then there was also two derivative works of that. And this was basically something that Pope Clement IV asked him to write. So this was his main work.
Now, what Opus Majus means in Latin is greater work.
Right.
Right. Yep. So Roger Bacon, this would be maybe an idea of a compendium of his of his knowledge.
Exactly.
And of course, written in Latin meant that he was educated.
Well, if we talk about alchemists that don't speak Latin, I think you can just assume that they're frauds. And there are those, and we will talk about them, but yeah, I think that they all have to kind of at least appear educated or they're just, no one will buy it. So yeah, this Opus Majus, it's, you know, like you said, a compendium. It's, you know, 840 pages about natural science, grammar, logic, mathematics, physics, philosophy. And of course, I wouldn't bring it up if you didn't at least mention alchemy. But some of the astronomical things, was kind of the size and distance of planets, which was really just speculation from his point. But he did review alchemy. Another interesting thing that I came across is that apparently he saw some firecrackers at one point. He kind of described a firecracker about as big as someone's thumb. And so this is right when gunpowder just starts to appear in Europe, and not in gun form by any means. So this was, he described it as a toy that made like a disproportionate noise for the size of the firecracker, you know, like someone's thumb. And he described it in very medieval language, which was fascinating to read.
Travis, in some of your readings, when we talk about gunpowder in this time, because I think some of that goes hand in hand with alchemy later on, of course. But did some of these early alchemists, and maybe including Roger Bacon, come up with the idea of the reason why there's a loud sound and a concussion blast is because air molecules are being pushed away.
No.
That was too early?
No. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they might have, if they felt a blast, you know, they might have had some strange explanation, but no, nothing like.
Okay, so that was a little ahead of the time at that point.
Oh yeah, they okay. would have, they would have had a totally mystical explanation for it, like some demon trapped in a rock and then has let loose something. You know, I don't want to say that that's what it was, but it's more along that nature than atoms bursting apart or even chemical reaction. You know, it's. I bring this up in the things that he actually did write about, because this he did write about, he kind of anticipated, call it future inventions. I mean, he clearly had an open mind, and he described things that, I'm going to put our modern words to it, and if you read his writings, it was much more obscure. But he wrote about things that we would call microscopes, telescopes, spectacles. We talked about, he talked about optics, okay?
Right.
But these things did not exist at his time. So he was saying, you can see something far away and see it clear, like it's in front of you, or see tiny, tiny things like they're big.
With convex lenses?
Yeah.
Was he getting that to that point?
He didn't know about convex lenses, but he anticipated. This was like science fiction. I mean, he was just guessing that someday we will have these things. So microscopes, telescopes, spectacles. But then he also mentioned flying machines, hydraulics, and something that you could call a steamship.
This kind of sounds a little bit like H.G. Wells meets Da Vinci.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't it? Yeah.
and I mean, Da Vinci was already further ahead. He also had this same grasp of things that are possible, even if he had no idea how to do them. You know, like he kind of had this helicopter thing. And Roger Bacon is somewhat in the same boat, that he just had an imagination that was just ahead of its time. I mean, he could imagine these things.
I don't know if we mentioned this in the beginning of the podcast yet, but this may be a little bit of a different deal, because he wasn't, other than teaching in Paris, I mean, he was an Englishman. So, I mean, he was from Somerset, England, in the 13th century. So I can't imagine his circles were really big in England when it comes to this kind of thought. This seems to be something that would be more continental in Europa, with the ideas of this alchemy. Is that a right concept or a wrong concept? Because alchemists, I mean, we've talked about before.
Ideas went back and forth.
Yeah.
And the alchemy influence, if I were to kind of guess where that came from, whether directly or indirectly, he did study some Arabic scripts, okay? And those are the same type of writings that they were studying on the mainland. So you have that same kind of Arabic influence that Albertus Magnus had, or Ramon Llull, or those guys. So maybe they had different conclusions because of a different cultural background, but in the end, it was still similar enough. I mean, one might recognize the other, and they're both writing in Latin, you know. So let's jump into some of the works that were probably not written by him, or you know, I wouldn't want to say for sure, and
maybe influenced.
Well, see, I think a lot of the works are just attributed to him that he just plain didn't write, but were a huge influence later to later alchemists, and they thought he wrote them. So sometimes that doesn't matter. Actually, it's good you bring that up, because the influence of the works sometimes is just as important whether he wrote it or not, okay? Because it doesn't matter who wrote this. There were these works, alchemical texts that someone thought Roger Bacon wrote, and then later they took these texts, no matter where they came from, and they built on them and created new ideas. So the reason I still bring them up here is that whether he wrote them or not, it's still part of his legacy, even if he had nothing to do with them. You know what I mean? They would quote him. His name would come up.
This sounds a lot about our previous podcast with Al-Ghazali. Reached so many different places, even if he wasn't around.
That he had, exactly. It was almost like a mythological context.
Yeah,
that by the time it reached Western Europe, they called him Al-Ghazal, and he was this, you know, semi-magician. And yeah, absolutely. It's similar to that. Now, we mentioned this next book. We mentioned this before, Voynich Manuscript. We mentioned this in the Rudolf II
podcast. Because it was in Rudolf II's collection.
Exactly.
In his crazy apartment here in Prague.
I'm grinning right now because I love remembering, like, his collection had, you know, nails from Noah's Ark, and I mean, you know,
I think we mentioned
splinters
this
of the cross.
If you could just say, can I take one
a Holy Grail?
I want to take one authentic tour. It's better than going to Universal Studios. All right, just let me get into Rudolph the Second's chamber area,
the Devil's Bible, all that stuff
I'll
is
be
just
happy.
Strewn around the world now. But this Voynich manuscript, this is one of the places it pops up, and I'll tell you right now, he almost certainly did not write it, okay? But still, when they were trying to figure out who could have, because of his reputation, it kind of came back to him. And what it is, again, we've mentioned this in another podcast, but this is this book that is in an unknown language. So it's probably made up. Even, you know, cryptographers cannot decipher it. Cryptographers are very clever people. So, you know, they know what they're doing. You know, there's all kinds of analysis you can do on a language, and it's just nothing fits. So they cannot tell. Even if it's a made-up alphabet, you could still tell if it's English or German or even Latin or Arabic, and it's none of those. It's just completely made up, totally indecipherable to date, I should say. This book has all these herbal plants, and it looks like, you know, it's from about that time period, and it's herbal plants and descriptions of them and possible medical uses and recipes and everything, but no one can decipher it. No one knows where it came from. It popped up in Rudolph II's collection. Okay, and actually, I think Rudolph II's collection is about the first time it came into history, but people speculated that Roger Bacon was the author. So it probably wasn't even written like hundreds of years after his death. But anyways, you know, it's a cool trivia fact, so I put it in there. We get into some other writings that, again, now these are possibly written by him, possibly not. They're not even sure when they were written, so it might not have even been in his lifetime. But the next couple ones we'll talk about, it is possible they were written by him. So and they definitely contributed to his reputation, and they were quoted later by him. So that's why we're going to go into it. That's why we're going to read about it. If someone says, well, if you know he didn't write it, don't talk about it. Well, still, our idea of Roger Bacon wouldn't be the same without these next books we're going to mention.
They go part and parcel with the myth and the man.
Exactly.
Okay.
So here they are. What's another one of them?
One of the works from Roger Bacon, and it's a little bit of a hazy date, but it's known as the Letter on the Secret Workings of Art and Nature and on the Vanity of Magic, sometimes alternatively entitled On the Wonderful Powers of Art and Nature. This treatise dismisses magical practices such as necromancy and contains most of the alchemical work attributed to Bacon, chiefly a formula on the Philosopher's Stone, which we talked about ad infinitum in previous podcasts, and perhaps one for gunpowder. It also contains a number of passages about hypothetical flying machines and what we would call today submarines, attributing to their first use to Alexander the Great.
Yeah, so some of this is clearly kind of pokey, bogus, but yeah, I did read some of what he supposedly wrote on the Philosopher's Stone, and it could have been written by him. I mean, it's definitely possible, so that's why I left it in. But yeah, saying that Alexander the Great used submarines,
yeah, I don't think so.
Not so much.
I'm going to say no to that one.
I'm going to call that one. Okay, another example of an alchemical manuscript was the Speculum Alchemiae, which was translated into English as the Mirror of Alchemy in 1597. It's a short treatise about the composition of and origin of metals, which a lot of alchemists had theories of the origin of metals. A lot of this was, he was kind of, you know, parroting or going along with the kind of conventional, let's call it that, you know, at least for the time period, Arabian theories of mercury and sulfur. And, you know, we talk about this in every podcast almost, like salt, mercury, sulfur.
Transmutation.
Yeah, what they have to do with metals and, you know, he didn't say transmutation, the word, but yes, like changing one thing to another. The Speculum Alchemy was probably not written by him. Like, if I had to put money on it either way. I have this book called The Alchemist Reader. I bring it up every once in a while. This is by Stanton J. Linden. And there's an excerpt from a book that he supposedly wrote called Radix Mundi. And I have my doubts whether he actually wrote it or not. This one may be kind of on the no side, but it does go along with what I have read, that he did believe in alchemy. So it is in the same vein. So that's why I put it in here. And regardless whether he wrote it or not, this one, the Radix Mundi, was quoted many times, and Roger Bacon was always as the author. So if someone says Roger Bacon was an influence on so-and-so, they might mean this book, and it might have not actually been written by him. So there you have it. He talks about the origin of metals, okay? And I'm going to summarize like 40 pages I read into a couple of paragraphs. And because it was written, I'm not even going to quote it because it's written in that strange alchemical weirdness that is just full of mythology and mysticism.
So we won't need our decoder rings for this.
You won't need I've already decoded it. Sort. I mean, bear with me here. So to make it really short, so origin of metals. He believed in the five elements in unison. So nothing new here. You know, earth, air, fire, water, spirit. Okay. Now you grow the metals with sulfur and mercury. Again, we've seen this 1,000 times. And naturally, this happens in the pores and veins of the mountains, which is, we've heard about this from Sendivogius, if you listen to that episode. While this is happening, this creates vapor of cloud, which is produced. And then thousands of years later, bam, you got metal and other minerals. Okay? You're welcome for condensing that for you, because that was
a nightmare to read.
Yeah. Just to get to, metals are created in the earth. Oh, really? Huh. But he said, you know, using sulfur and mercury. So this is the natural process, okay? But you can do this in your own home. Please do not try this at home. But you can do this in your own home. So you can quicken this by making the tincture. So this is, again, this is the elixir of life, the philosopher's stone, liquid gold, okay? But he called
a thick water?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tincture. They call it all different things. In fact, they even call it the universal medicine if it can make you better. But universal medicine can be made out of gold. So this is, all these ideas flow together, but they don't mean the same thing to the same alchemist. But so he described it as, like you said, a thick water that when returned to the earth becomes fixed. So you can be faster than nature by using this tincture, okay? So mercury is both stone and no stone. It swallows other things and is swallowed by other things. It is the basis of the tincture, right? So the elixir, the philosopher's stone, okay? And Razis, he quoted Razis, which is, his real name was like Al-Razi or something like that. He was an Arab, but again, you know, just like Al-Ghazali was Al-Ghazal. So Razis is quoted as saying, such a thing may be made of it which exceedeth the highest perfection of nature. So this philosopher's stone can do a better job in a faster time than nature can by itself. And did it work as advertised? I have my doubts. Okay, so our stone, the philosopher's stone that we made, is natural or mineral, vegetable and animal, because it's generated in the mines, mother or womb of metal. It springs and grows like a vegetable and abounds with life like an animal. Do you buy that, Pete? Is that?
I would say this is the stuff I would hear walking down the street on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. All right, this is what I would hear.
My stone is metal, and
can I have something else to drink?
This is mineral and animal.
Yeah, I think I can see where someone would be saying, wow, you've kind of left the area of common thought, right? You know,
you've left the building.
You've imbibed some of this mercury, which you should not do.
You know, a lot of these are scholars, so they read Aristotle. They read about the five elements, or, you know, four or five elements, whatever, and then the three other substances and the, you know, the four humors, you know, whatever. And this is, you know, basing their science, if you will, which I won't, basing their knowledge off of that and then expanding on it, this is what you get. I mean, it's logical. It's just not real. But okay, you know. He talked about the tools you would need for the purification of metal. And he talked about glass, you know, that it's transparent. And then also kind of lab equipment, like, you know, that it's hermetically sealed so no fumes escape. They didn't say fumes. They would say something like vapors or the air, you know, some more mythological terminology. But, you know, he was describing a chemistry set. I mean, you know, hermetically sealed glass, whatever, beaker or something. Okay, but now we get back into the weirdness again pretty quickly, because soul mercury. So he would talk about the sun, and he would talk about that the sun is mercury and the moon is something else, salts or whatever. And so you're talking about the white and the red. So he would talk about that, you know, and this happens over and over again. So this is like that same language. So red is gold, white is silver, the sun is gold, the moon is silver. So you're always combining the two, okay? So the white and the red. Marry the white man to the red woman or something like that. And that has a meaning of, you know, mix the mercury with the sulfur, or mix the mercury with the metal, or, you know, so there's always
a double meaning.
Yeah, we see this over, and you see pictures. Like, I'm going to scan some pictures one of these days, and it is just crazy, like, to fix something. So we would say a chemical bond, okay? So you mix A with B, and that creates C, which is a compound, okay? But they would call it to transfix something. And then you'd see an illustration of someone skewering a snake with a sword to a tree. And they're describing a chemical process. But not if you saw that picture, that is not what you would think is going on.
That's not one of these hiking symbols on a tree saying camp here, is what you're trying to tell me.
Right.
If I see a snake skewer to a tree, I'm probably going to go the other direction.
You're like, oh, there's a chemist around.
I wouldn't be saying that as a warning.
Like marry the white man to the red woman. So you would see a couple. You'd see a man wearing red and a woman wearing white, and you know, but that would be describing like mixing two chemical compounds. So now you're also talking about moist and dry fire. So they mean not too hot, because dry fire, is there moist fire? I don't know. But they're talking about, you know, keeping it within a certain temperature or a certain type of fire. And it had to be very stable. So this almost gets into some more modern science, because without these laboratory processes, you know, they did... If there's one thing alchemists did do for a fact, it's create better lab equipment and better ways to, you know, have constant hearths and, you know, constant temperatures for months at a time.
Well, let's put it this way. This is not new science for this era of time, because when we talk about ceramics, this has been going on since thousands of years, where people would have a set temperature, because if you did not have a certain temperature for some types of ceramics, it would crack, or the glaze would not be as good, or a strong bond with this clay. So many artisans that worked with ceramics had a precise heating issue built by the kiln that they built.
Actually, it's funny you should mention that, because porcelain in the West was alchemists.
Makes complete sense.
Yeah.
Because they had
the equipment to do it.
Yeah, they're using old basic science and saying, okay, how can I attribute it to this new kind of fangled sort of thought of making or transmutation of other elements, right?
Yeah, so they had the equipment to then do other things. But okay, so back down the rabbit hole. Now he would talk about decoct, commix, conjoin, sublime, bake, grind, congeal, make equal, putrefy, make white, then red. So these are all things that we can understand, you know, mix and join and, you know, boil down, distill, congeal. Okay.
It sounds like Shakespeare.
Is
it close?
But like make white, then red. Like they would say, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's Roger Bacon's. I don't want to jump to another episode here, but you're talking about waiting for something to cook until it's black and then waiting a couple more days, usually, or even longer, and then it will slowly turn white, you know, and keeping the whole thing sealed so the vapor doesn't escape. So this is, you know, so they'd use colors to say, okay, so wait till it gets black, and then, you know, keep going on, and then it turns white, and then take it from the, you know, something like this. But then they would take this simple idea, and then they would go off. So again, like some of these paintings and drawings that you'd see would just have some crazy meaning about black guy, not a black guy, but a person wearing black and then a person wearing
now,
red.
To me, at this time, when witch burning was probably getting kicked into gear here in Europe, this would seem like witchcraft.
Oh, yes.
Is that what other people saw as?
Yeah, if they saw an alchemist lab, they would assume, not all the time, but a lot of times the distinction between this and sorcery, they just didn't know what was going on. So here's this guy that is well-educated and speaks Latin, and their neighbors just constantly smell sulfur, which, you know, that has a strong connotation to hell. So there was a lot of kind of iffy reputations being made here in the process. So then he would talk about checking your work, okay, which is smart advice. So keeping your glassware half out of the fire so you can see it. Then you'd say something like a 40-day check. Okay, and then you would see the black crust from the mercury, which is called the fires, the soul, the cloud, raven's head, coal, oil, aqua vitae, tincture of redness, shadow of the sun, black brass, water of sulfur. Okay, we're talking about black sulfur. That's it. But they would use these crazy terms, Shadow of the Sun. Just, you with me? Like you're just watching.
I go back to my original statement. This does sound like witchcraft.
Yeah, but you're just watching yeah. sulfur burn in a fire. But then they attribute these crazy names to it, and these crazy names don't help make it clear to the average reader.
Well, maybe it's not supposed to, Travis. It's not. Maybe it's not. Supposed to be something that you recite and remember. Because written word might be hard for others to read.
Here's
right?
the thing: is that and there's a lot of pictures, and a lot of that could be due to that. Yeah, but it was always supposed to be hidden knowledge. On the first episode, we talked about what esoterica means. Okay, and this was not meant for everyone. This was dangerous for some people. This was you're playing with nature, which means you're playing with God's knowledge. So you don't want to abuse that. Just like now, some people say you don't want to do stem cell research. I mean, it's just same.
Or maybe more appropriately,
genetic
cloning. Yeah. Genetically
modified stuff is just completely banned in Europe. Like we do not eat genetically modified food.
Might be
here.
Something to that genetic banning, you know, when it comes to some of those things.
So
it's,
some people would say, well, you're playing God. You don't know what you're doing, so don't do it. So if you're going to do it, then describe it in a language that not everyone understands. So that is you need to be initiated into the fold of alchemy to be able to interpret.
So you're saying maybe this prose that he's saying is not so much for recitation, but more so for coding.
Yeah, it could be because another thing, like you just said, you could have a fairy tale storybook, and that another alchemist might be able to read what that says, but they would have to be told what that says first, and then they'd be able to read what that says. Okay, so the point is, when it's all done, you can add pure gold to this. You've just created the aqua vitae, the elixir of life. Okay, but we think of it more as philosopher's stone in this sense, in Roger Bacon's context. So he wasn't after eternal life. So add some pure gold, okay? Let that ferment, and when you pour the gold out, this can be done indefinitely. So you've just created gold. And now, again, it becomes very murky, but he says you can do this up to 10 times, 100 times. Depending on how you do it and how much gold you add, you can get 10,000 times more gold than with you started. And it's really, that paragraph is really hard to understand what he meant. This would be a good time for listener mail, because I do not understand what he was saying when he said that. But you add some gold to it. You need the gold, but then you can just keep pouring it out. It'll just keep coming. He said sometimes it's 10 times. Sometimes if you've done it really well, it's 100,000 times. So, he said 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times. Anyways, now he talks about that there's fraudster alchemists that in vain do all their, and this is interesting, they do all their distillations, sublimations, conjunctions, calcinations, dissolutions, cointritions, etc., etc. Okay, and he says that that's not all necessary. You saw how easy the recipe was we just read a minute ago. That's all you need. All these other fraudsters add additional levels on it to make it even more complicated because they're frauds. So they just try to obscure it so much that it means nothing. Here's the thing. If you just understood what I said, that's because God let you understand. If you did not understand what I just said, that's not my fault. I'm not a fraud. It's because God did not want you to understand. So the whole white, the man in white marrying the woman in red, if you didn't get that, that's because you weren't supposed to. So if you didn't understand the snake eating his own tail and the shadow of the sun, that's not my fault. I'm not a fraudster. That's because God doesn't want you to understand. Remember, he's a Franciscan. You need to be right with God before you can understand the gold recipe. When you're right with God, God will open your eyes. And, if you're good, if you deserve it, he will reveal these secrets to you.
Is this where the fraud term snake oil comes from?
No.
It sounds like it would be a perfect fit right here for snake oil.
This might be something for your podcast, Bohemican. I saw someone at a dog show, which I don't want to talk about. I saw someone selling, I kid you not, snake oil. And he had snakes in like formaldehyde and everything on the thing. And it was a big, like modern, it wasn't like old timey, look at me, I'm selling snake oil. No. He had a booth set up with a modern picture of a snake, like a logo. And it had all these in check. I took a picture of it. I'll have to put it on your blog and you can talk about it. He had a picture, or it was in check, writing the benefits of things you get from snake, a.k.a. snake oil. Kid you not, 2013.
I never would have thought. That's something I would think I would have heard maybe the turn of the 20th century.
Well, welcome
someplace in Indiana.
Welcome to the Czech Republic, my friend.
Oh, wow. That is something else. So when you look at Roger Bacon in the sense of what he's known for, remembered for, we talked about some of the literature, some of the books, some of the people that attached themselves to his name or to his mythology or mythos. You would have to also look at his connection to gunpowder. Some would say that Bacon is often considered to be the first European to describe the mixture containing the essential ingredients for gunpowder. Now, right. Of course, that's a big step if we're talking about, you know, before the era of the East meeting West in the sense of China that it had gunpowder for many centuries.
I did read that passage. I think he had an idea because he mentioned something like saltpeter and everything. But if he was able to reproduce it or anything, you know, I don't know.
Well, and this kind of lends to the idea that people would call him the real first scientist, which is really kind of a stretch.
I would say it's a stretch. Yeah,
you know,
but you're right. I mean,
you know, because he did talk about chemical processes and talked about some of those things. But I think he was. I wouldn't say he was a man before his time, but let's just say maybe he set the inspiration for others to follow.
Sure,
that might be something we hang our hat on when we talk about Roger Bacon. Taking a look at how he even influenced modern day. I don't know if you remember this movie or not, but In the Name of the Rose. This is. Maybe in the late 1980s?
I watched it about then.
Yeah, in the late 1980s, Sean Connery's a monk, and it's a detective story in the Middle Ages. And his apprentice is a very – not a very young, but right after Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah.
You know, Matthew Broderick, that was his second role, and it was Sean Connery.
I'm going to have to rewatch that.
Now you have to watch it, exactly. And so
I barely remember that movie.
A Sherlock Holmes-like medieval – sort of monks discovering a murder mystery with a crazy monk that had no, I believe, had cloudy eyes. It'll freak you out. Freak you out. All right, so, you know, see if you can find that movie at some point. But he is mentioned in there as well. So, his name sort of lives on, and of course, it'll live on in our podcast as an alchemist of certain acclaim. And I think that is a name that probably should not be forgotten in alchemist circles.
Sure.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter. @AlchemyPodcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on Bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.